Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, U.S. reaction to China's reported deployment of a missile system in a disputed island chain. Apple rejects an order to help the FBI gain access to an alleged shooter's iPhone. There is U.S.-Cuban agreement on U.S. commercial flights to Cuba. And we'll hear about Taylor Swift shining once again at the Grammys.
She really looked great. The confetti was flying, and it was a great opening to the show.
Coming up right here on The Voice of America. China has deployed an advanced surface-to-air missile system to one of the disputed islands it has claimed in the South China Sea, a move that is likely to increase tensions among China, its neighbors, and others like the United States. Taiwan's defense ministry says the missile batteries have been set up on Woody Island, which is part of the Paracel Island chain. Images from a civilian satellite company first revealed by U.S.-based Fox News shows two batteries of eight surface-to-air missile launchers as well as a radar system. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said in Beijing that the reports of the missile deployment are the creations of some Western media and do not reflect the reality of China's activities in the South China Sea. However, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is taking the issue very seriously and made a statement a little earlier. Let's listen in.
President Xi was here in Washington. He stood in the Rose Garden with President Obama and said, China will not militarize in the South China Sea. But there is every evidence, every day, that there has been an increase of militarization of one kind or another. It's a serious concern. We've had these conversations with the Chinese, and I'm confident that over the next days, we will have further very serious conversation on this. And my hope is that China will realize that it is important to try to resolve the jurisdictional issues of the South China Sea, not through unilateral action, not through force, not through militarization, but through diplomacy, and by working with the other countries and claimants in trying to resolve these differences.
Joining us on the line right now is correspondent Pam Dawkins, who is over at the State Department. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
Hey, what is the feeling about China's actions over where you are?
Well, although the U.S. says it does not take sides in the South China Sea territorial dispute, there has been repeated U.S. criticism of China's efforts to develop these islands. Secretary of State Kerry has raised this issue repeatedly with his Chinese counterpart and also expressed U.S. concerns about how this action is considered destabilizing to the region. Now, the timing of this deployment is interesting. It is, of course, coming just as President Barack Obama has wrapped up hosting leaders of the ASEAN nations, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, in a special U.S. summit in California. And during this summit, he called for tangible steps to lower tensions over the ongoing territorial disputes in the South China Sea.
A U.S. Navy destroyer, you'll remember, Pam, sailed through the disputed South China Sea. It was an action Beijing denounced as a provocation. Is there anything more the U.S. is planning to do to express its objection to China's actions in the region?
Well, this is an issue that the U.S. has raised repeatedly with regional allies. It was a topic during Secretary Kerry's recent trip to the region, which included a stop in China as well as in Cambodia and Laos. It's unclear if the U.S. will move to take any additional steps because of this new development, but it's definitely something that has been an issue that the U.S. has been paying close attention to and closely monitoring.
Well, thank you very much, Pam. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today. And joining me with the details is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew, as always.
Good to be here, as always.
Thanks.
Well, Apple, of course, the manufacturer of iPhones, iPads, all of that, is trending today. And you're going to hear a little bit after this segment about
that. Right,
we
have our social media guy joining us later to talk about this as well.
Yes, Doug Bernard, who's
right.
A very talented reporter. But he'll explain some of the details, but basically the 30,000-foot view is that Apple is facing off with the FBI over a request to unlock a phone from one of the San Bernardino shooters. And so this has sparked a lot of concern on social media. On my Facebook news feed, a lot of my friends are posting this saying, I don't know how this is going to work or what the precedent that this is going to set for having FBI, other organizations, government organizations, access people's information.
Yeah, on the one hand, you want to help the police catch these bad guys. But on the other hand, there's a matter of personal privacy.
Right, and that's what people are weighing on social media and having that conversation. Apple has released a letter where they said, basically, we want to have a conversation with you, our customers. And a lot of people sharing that letter saying, all right, let's start this conversation. Let's talk about this. So hopefully a civil discussion on this issue and one that'll lead to a result that hopefully, if not pleasing everyone, at least is a good compromise between all of these different sides. And on a lighter note and a happier note, it is hashtag Random Acts of Kindness
Day. I think that's a great day.
Which is a great thing.
We all should be doing that every day.
Top trending in the U.S. and around the world. So nice random acts of kindness we're seeing on social media. Two that I saw that I really liked. Someone said, if you're in line to get coffee, pay for somebody behind you. Pay it, not forward, but pay it back.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody else said, I'm going to go on Twitter and I'm just going to tweet random nice things to people as I randomly see them on Twitter. So happy Random Act of Kindness Day
happy
to everyone out there.
Random Act of Kindness Day.
Hopefully everyone out there in our listening audience will be doing some random acts of kindness and spreading that around the world.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A team of experts at North Carolina's Duke University are tweaking a simple new blood test they've developed that will allow medical professionals to determine whether a respiratory illness stems from a viral or bacterial infection. Bacterial infections are usually treated with antibiotics, which are ineffective against viral infections. The test will help doctors pinpoint the appropriate antibiotics to fight the infection if it's bacterial in nature and consider treatments other than antibiotics if caused by a virus. The scientists who are developing this blood test say they hope that it will help stem the trend of overprescribing antibiotics, which some say has led to an increase of antimicrobial resistant bacterial strains. One of the lead researchers, Dr. Ephraim Salik, said that about 3/4 of respiratory patients are prescribed antibiotics despite the fact that the majority actually have viral infections. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
U.S. District Judge in Los Angeles, California, has ordered engineers at Apple to unlock an encrypted iPhone that was allegedly used by one of the shooters involved in the December 2nd attack in San Bernardino last year. Apple has refused to comply with this first-of-its-kind ruling. The legal standoff follows years of friction between law enforcement officials, notably the FBI, and tech companies like Apple and Google over the increased use of encryption technology that can permanently lock devices and the data stored on them. International Edition's Doug Bernard covers cyber news and joins us now here in the studio. Hi, Doug.
Hello again.
Hey, could you please speak with us about what specifically this judge has ruled?
Sure. So the word that you used was unlocked and not decrypt. Basically, there's a program on that Apple phone that says you get 10 tries to enter your personal code or whatnot. And if you exceed 10 tries, then all of your data on that phone is erased. So that means that the FBI can't do sort of a brute force just trying codes, you know, for months at a time. So what the judge has asked is that Apple create a bit of software that would disable that phone, thus allow the FBI to get in and potentially decrypt it. But Apple, of course, as you just mentioned, Apple has refused. They say they won't do it. And they also say that there's probably a good likelihood that they can't.
Well, why are they refusing?
Well, there's several reasons. One, Apple has made a selling point, as have other companies, that they're now offering encryption, robust encryption, and encryption that they don't have the keys for. You know, people are very security-minded these days, especially, you know, in the wake of all the hack attacks that we hear about and the Edward Snowden revelations. So this is a real selling point for Apple. Now, they also couch it in sort of legal and, you know, ethical terms. This is the right thing to do. But really, you know, at some level, this is a business decision. If they're the first that's forced to unlock a device, you can see a lot of customers leaving Apple.
Well, you've reported before about FBI Director James Comey's warnings about the dangers of encryption. What are the possible outcomes here?
Sure. So Mr. Comey has used this phrase repeatedly. He warns that encryption will, quote, take us to a very dark place. Now, dark in this case means simply inaccessible to law enforcement agencies. But there's, I think, a lot that kind of carries with it this idea of darkness, of you know, sort of bad uses by bad people of this technology. What we're looking at right now was inevitable, and there's really only one outcome. Apple is going to comply with the order, or this is just going to simply be litigated, you know, up through the court system. We may see this for years, and in that time, I think it's probably more likely that the government, the FBI, and other law enforcement agencies are going to try to work with these manufacturers to develop some different new kind of system, maybe not a front door or a back door, maybe a system that we've been reading about called a shattered key system. But I think they're going to try and work it out through discussion and agreement rather than through the court system.
Well, this has implications all the way from a personal level, like if something were to happen to me, how would my husband get into my phone?
Yes.
But it also has international implications. What if a big government hacks and gets the system in order to go in the back door? They could get into everybody's phones everywhere.
And in fact, that's actually one of the points that Apple CEO Tim Cook has been making repeatedly. You know, you can say, well, it's a secure back door, we've got lots of locks on it and that kind of thing. But as we know, any time that there is any entry into a system, whether it's your phone, your computer, your iPad, people will find a way into it. If you build it, they will break in. And that could be bad guys, hackers, or it could be bad governments. So I think there's a real pushback on the part of industry and cyber types to say that any talk of any new doors is just going to lead to a, you know, a compromised system.
Well, thank you very much, Doug, for stopping by.
Oh, you bet.
Coming up on International Edition, another step in changing U.S.-Cuban relations. And Taylor Swift has her day at the Grammys. The United States and Cuba have announced an agreement that will permit up to 110 daily U.S. commercial flights to Cuba. It's the latest sign of improving ties following the reestablishment of diplomatic relations last July. It will allow the first American commercial flight service to the communist-ruled country in more than 50 years. Currently, only charter flights provide regular air service between the two countries. U.S. Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox calls the aviation agreement a critically important milestone in greater engagement, although tourism will remain limited due to Cuba's antiquated infrastructure and the U.S. trade embargo, which remains in effect. Rodrigo Malmierca Diaz, Cuban Minister of Foreign Trade and Investment, said he hoped the embargo would be lifted soon and pledged U.S. companies would not be discriminated against.
In our side, we are going to treat the American companies the same we treat all the others from all over the place, the places in the world. We are not going to discriminate the American companies. We are not going to make the processes more complicated or whatever. We want, I explained today during lunch and before in the other meetings, that we need the foreign investment to come to Cuba. It's an important component to promote the economic development of Cuba. So we are not creating barriers. We want them to come. We are promoting this. So it would be stupid on our side to delay things. No, we don't want to do that.
Rice University Latin American analyst Mark Jones tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that until the embargo is lifted by Congress, American travel to Cuba will remain limited.
Right now, travelers still have to maintain the fiction that they're going for educational reasons or religious reasons or business reasons, not for pure tourism. Although that's moved from a strict requirement to something of a fig leaf where the Treasury Department doesn't really check it much anymore.
Will that limit travel?
Well, it certainly limits it somewhat in that restriction is still there. And so if you are going for pure tourism, you either don't go to Cuba or you're deceptive when applying for permission to go to Cuba. For the average traveler who's debating between traveling to Cuba or traveling to the Bahamas or to Mexico, that will represent a extra added hurdle that will discourage some leisure travelers. On the other hand, the mystery of traveling to Cuba, something that people haven't done much recently, that should at the same time counteract that by making Cuba a little more attractive and exotic of a destination.
It comes just one day after an Alabama-based company is going to be allowed to manufacture small tractors in Cuba. The pace seems to be picking up, and there is one report that suggests the Obama administration, before it leaves office within a year, is trying to make the trend irreversible for a future president.
Well, I think President Obama already has made this trend irreversible. It's like a snowball that's rolling downhill. The president's pushed it, and it's now at such a pace that no one could get in the way of it, and no one really wants to, because outside of a small, isolated group in Miami-Dade County, and a few other places, no one really opposes relaxing ties with Cuba and restoring normal diplomatic and commercial relations with the country. It's only a very small minority of the U.S. population that actually is blocking it. An overwhelming majority of Americans want to see a normalization of ties with Cuba, and that's what President Obama is delivering with this. And it's only a process that's going to become more and more normalized as we move in the future. At this point, President Obama has moved things so much forward that it's virtually impossible for anyone to go back unless there's some unexpected development inside of Cuba, such as a crackdown.
And Mark Jones says he doesn't anticipate the U.S. trade embargo, first imposed in 1960 and strengthened in 1962, will be lifted anytime soon. And even when it is lifted, he doesn't believe it will result in the democratization of Cuba. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
A computer made in Sweden is changing the lives of children in Argentina with neurological diseases. A computer called Toby enables users to communicate with their eye movements. Sheila Levy's 7-year-old son, Ian, has chronic encephalitis, which affects his speech and motor skills.
What has changed with Ian is that he can play on his own, turn the television on, share a moment with his brothers.
Toby's eye-tracking technology also allows disabled children like Ian to participate in standard school classes, says therapist Natalia Ibarra.
One very important thing is the smile on children's faces when they manage to use the device and the independence that it gives them.
At about $14,000, Toby is an expensive device, but the price has been dropping. And organizations like Ian Levy's school in Buenos Aires can use them for more than one student. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
Larry London has joined us, and I know that's always going to be a fun time because Larry's a fun kind of guy. And today he tells me he wants to focus on Taylor Swift, wonderful, talented, good-looking woman, singer.
Exactly. And I was going to focus on Captain Sue, but I've decided instead.
Our listeners don't know who that is. When I was in college, I was called Captain Sue.
We're going to talk about Taylor, who, in my opinion, was one of the better opening numbers for the Grammy. She sang her brand new single, which is Out of the Woods, which is the sixth release from her 1989 album. And she looked great. She had this sparkly one-piece bodysuit on and a short bob hair. She looked great. She really looked great. The confetti was flying. And it was a great opening to the show. And speaking of the 1989 album, that's the story, because the biggest award of the night, obviously, that everyone waits to find out, is the album of the year. And Taylor made history this year when she got it for the second time.
I wanted to ask you something, because you know this stuff. I read that the Grammys are kind of old because she wins so much. And they thought it was old stuff that she won, and they thought that the rap singer should have won.
Kendrick Lamar? Well, you know, there's different schools, different camps. People believe different things, and there will always be, you know, who should have won the Super Bowl.
Right.
You'll always get that, the factions of fans. And I don't think it's, you know, gotten boring or stale or predictable. She only got one Grammy, and so I think she deserved it. The 1989 album produced 6 hits. No other album has produced that many hits. And as I mentioned, the last time she did this was 2010. She was only 20 years old at the time. Her album Fearless won Album of the Year. She's the only female in Grammy history to do that, to win 2 Album of the Year Grammy Awards. The last time it was done, it was 1975. Stevie Wonder did it. So that's how rare it is, and that's how special this particular event was for Taylor Swift. And she gave a great acceptance speech.
Is she going to be like the Cher of her generation?
I don't know, because Taylor Swift is known not so much as a singer, although she is a singer. She's known as a songwriter. I think Cher is not really known as a songwriter.
No.
But Taylor Swift kind of writes great songs, and a lot of her great songs draw on personal events and experiences, including relationships. A lot of the songs talk about past relationships and leave us all guessing, who was that one about?
I've heard she's a little sensitive about that, though.
Yes, she is. As a matter of fact, you know, she doesn't want to talk about her personal life too much. She's sensitive on a variety of subjects. You may remember at the MTV Awards in 2009, Kanye West grabbed the microphone out of her hand when she was accepting an award, and he said Beyonce had the video of the year. Well, Kanye West has a new song out called Famous that pokes fun of Taylor Swift, and he says he made Taylor Swift famous.
Oh.
And when she got her Best Album Grammy, she said, I want to just say for women all around the world and for artists all around the world, own it. It's yours. You deserve it. She said, I deserve this. No one else gets credit for this but me.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Larry. And let's listen to her song, Blank Space.
Yes, this song was nominated for a Song of the Year, so let's listen.
To meet you where you've been, I could show you incredible things, magic, madness, heaven, sin. Saw you there and I thought, oh my God, look at that face. You look like my next mistake. Love's a game, wanna play. New money, suit and tie, I can read you like a magazine. Ain't it funny?
If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Democracy is critical to Africa's future. But if democracy is to take root and flourish, specific conditions must be met. Chief among these are free and fair elections. These, in turn, cannot take place if the voting public lacks access to information about important issues, or if voters are prevented from meeting with or rallying for their chosen candidates. In other words, freedom of speech and of the press and freedom of association are indispensable aspects of free elections and of democracy itself. That is why the United States is concerned about the deteriorating electoral environment in Uganda and the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections set to be held on February 18th. 8 candidates are vying for the presidency, including sitting president Yoweri Museveni, who first came to power in 1986 but was only elected into office in 1996. He is currently running for a 5th term in office. According to Human Rights Watch, Uganda's current election campaign is fraught with intimidation of journalists, including threats or warnings of possible repercussions for critical reporting, government harassment and intimidation of independent voices in the media and civil society, obstruction and dispersal by police of opposition rallies with excessive illegal arrests, beatings, and other use of force by security personnel. At least one member of a candidate's staff, opposition campaign aide Christopher Aine, has disappeared. For the sake of Uganda and all of its people, the upcoming elections must be free, fair, and transparent. The United States believes that for this to happen, all Ugandans must have the opportunity to exercise their right to assemble peacefully, express their opinions, and participate in the electoral process free from intimidation and abuse. They also depend on government institutions and security forces remaining neutral, defending the rights of all people and protecting all parties equally, wrote State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a statement. We call on the government, civil society, and political parties to do their part to ensure a peaceful, transparent, and credible electoral process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.